all have said that Ruhleben, they've said it quite explicitly, they've all said at various points in their life that Ruhleben was the beginning of the best part of their career. I think it's this notion of being thrown together at such intensity with such a large number of cultural figures. The editor of the Irish Times was there. There were great writers. There was Sam Wolstenholme, who went on to become a great footballer. So from all walks of life, all kinds of, you know, really amazing men were there. It must have been an extraordinary experience, disturbing, upsetting, but also invigorating and quite remarkable.
How materially do you think Ruhleben affected these men?
Oh, profoundly. I'm sure that many of them, despite the horrendous psychological effects of internment, found this intense sort of hothousing of talent terribly helpful. For me, most profoundly, what they would have taken from this is the idea that you don't have to be a toff, you don't have to be a lord, you don't have to be well-connected to be part of a musical community. And whether that's Ruhleben itself or whether Ruhleben is part of a broader historical process is difficult to say, but we can certainly say for these men, Ruhleben was formative.
The more I've spent time with these men and their stories, the more bizarre it seems that we know so little about their internment. But the echoes of the camp are unmistakable. Even though these men went on to very different careers, whether they thrived at Ruhleben or not, each was galvanised into communicating their love of music. They had learnt how essential it was to human survival. Never again would they be silenced. I'm Kate Kennedy. The Ruhleben Legacy was produced by Matt Willis and Dave Anderson. It was a 7 Digital production for BBC Radio 3.
All of Radio 3's Sunday features are available as a podcast on BBC Sounds.
Stop. Do you hear that? It's the sound of sleep by Max Richter.
Sleep is a kind of landscape for the sleeping mind to inhabit. It's a place of rest and a place to pause from our busy lives.
BBC Radio 3 presents the full 8-hour work in a special pan-European broadcast.
I think particularly now, when there's so much trouble and anxiety and suffering in the world, could all do with a place to rest.
Relax. Listen. Sleep by Max Richter. Available now on BBC Sounds.
Now we're going over to the Alexandra Palace Theatre, where our Drama on Three was recorded in front of a live audience. It's a new play by Robin Brooks telling the story of Queen Elizabeth I and her favourite, the Earl of Essex, based on the writings of Lytton Strachey, with the music of Erich Korngold. The BBC Concert Orchestra is tuning up and the conductor, Robert Ziegler, is about to take to the podium.
I have the germ of an idea. Elizabeth I. I'm appalled by the mass of matter to be digested and by the small number of remarks that occur to me to say about it. But I must write something. Bad Queen Bess. I shall start my researches at once. I have peace and relative quiet. I have all my comforts. I have my hot water bottle. But I have lost the stopper. I want to achieve something. not unworthy of my hopes, my imaginations, and the spirit that I feel to be mine. Oh, to bound forward and triumph. It might be rather fun.
How is the book going?
Oh, dear Otty, I think I've forgotten how to write.
Oh, dear.
I'm finding it almost impossible.
Really? Why?
I've been having such a tussle with the Virgin Queen. She has exhausted me.
You don't really want to be Elizabethan.
Au contraire, I would be willing to return to that age with alacrity. No railways, no fig leaves.
What if you came back a slave?
I might be a doorkeeper at the Globe. With a bit of luck, I might be at a cockfight.
What if you were the cock?
At least I would die a violent death. And I wouldn't have to wear braces. I might be the flaunting man of fashion.
Whose codpiece proclaims an astonishing virility.
But with my hose and my flowing hair and my jewelled ears...
Ears?
Yes. Am I not feminine? I want to enter the world of my own imagination, but sometimes I have difficulty disentangling the real from the unreal. I have visions. I might be Elizabeth.
So, stand still, please.
Perhaps the truth is that I'm not an artist.
Well, then what the devil are you?
Otty, what are you doing to my nether regions?
You did say you'd like to try my high heels.
Oh. Yes. You are a woman of Elizabethan extravagance, Ottoline, at once mystical and possessive, quixotic and forceful.
Do stand still.
You would be my vizier. You would be Francis Bacon.
The other foot, please, Your Majesty.
Most elevating.
Take a step.
The music of the spheres enchants me as I walk. What a pity one can't now and then change sexes. Or can't one?
Majestic. Enchanting, regal.
I could be the queen, a goddess moving in a nimbus of golden glory.
An old creature fantastically dressed.
A peculiar embodiment of supreme energy.
Red hair above her pale visage.
While the vile sound, young men grouped about me await what destiny will bring forth.
Is she not a virgin? Is she not old?
I'm a dream. of regal womanliness. I feel as though I'm in a golden mist, moving between fact and fiction, between fantasy and reality, into the realm of poetic drama, of the most passionate affairs of the heart. Lytton, at a dance, Ottoline invited me.
Cooey!
Cooey, Otty.
And how goes the book? How fares Her Majesty?
Dear Maynard, I feel doubtful about the whole thing and rather ashamed of myself.
Why?
A middle-aged literary man with beard and eyeglasses, gallivanting in damask and pearls and ruff. It's ridiculous.
Then why be queen? Why not be the subtle statesman, ambitious and urgent? Enjoying the splendours of high living, the intricacies of court intrigue, the exquisiteness of pages. Why not be Secretary Cecil?
You be Cecil. I will be Queen.
Then you should visit Hampton Court.
Oh, I did better than that. I got Eddie Sackville-West to show me over his country house at Knowle.
Knowle. And?
Sadly pokey. He's so pleased with this, and I can see no sign of taste anywhere. I'm thinking of becoming a communist.
So what will be the story of this new work, Your Majesty? The Armada? Shakespeare?
Oh.
Philip of Spain? Mary, Queen of Scots?
Oh, really, Maynard?
Intrigue behind the arras while the Queen dances in the candlelight?
I say, Otty!
Hello!
Otty! Who is that young man?
Where?
That one, that beautiful flower, wilting so gracefully against the wall.
Oh, Roger. Shall I introduce you?
Yes, please. Do you come here often?
No. Do you, like dancing very much?
No, not at all.
Nor do I. In any case, I'm going out of town.
Oh. And in any case, Roger, how does one dance? I can never understand how anyone ever manages it. The nerve.
The important thing about dancing is that it brings the sexes into close physical contact, closer than is allowed by the conventions of society on any other occasion.
Really?
Did you not know that?
Well...
But that's why... that's why stupid mothers who don't understand or don't like really good intellectual conversation think that giving dances is the best way of getting their daughters married.
Very interesting. The contact question never struck me before.
I'm surprised to hear you say that. When you gave your paper at the Society, I thought you said you were only in love with women physically.
Not women.
No?
Only men. Lord, perfectly charming.
The Queen likes him well.
A handsome, charming youth.
With his open manner.
His boyish spirits.
His looks of adoration.
The body of an athlete by Praxiteles, the freshness and piquancy of an unimaginable English youth.
His exquisite hands.
His ears.
Ears?
Mm-hmm. He's unique. An exquisite undergraduate, my hand trembles, my heart palpitates, my whole being swoons away. Oh, heavens, Heavens, I rave. He is like the young Earl of Essex. Oh, Essex. Elizabeth and Essex. Oh. 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 Elizabeth and Essex, starring Lytton Strachey. Celebrated author of Eminent Victorians as Elizabeth. And any young man he fancies at the moment as the Earl of Essex. With Lady Ottoline Morell, wealthy patroness of the Bloomsbury Group, as Francis Bacon. And introducing Mr. John Maynard Keynes, the notorious economist, as Sir Robert Cecil. Cinematography by absolutely no one. Lady Ottoline's gowns by Madame Sue Ryder. Not filmed in any studio anywhere. And not very much in Technicolor at all. With music by Eric Wolfgang Korngold.
The Earl of Essex was brought up in the country.
All the ingredients are present for the making of a fine career. High birth, great traditions, influence.
Even poverty.
And when he is but a youth, Robert Devereux, second Earl of Essex, comes to court.
The Queen is how old at this point?
42.
Really?
53.
She is 53, and he is 24, a dangerous combination of ages.
Yet, for the moment, all is well.
There are long walks and rides through the parks and woods around London.
In the pursuit of verisimilitude, I'm taking riding lessons.
How are you getting on?
I can sometimes trot for several minutes together with absolute equanimity.
I say.
The joys of cantering make me turn pale with ecstasy merely to think of.
Cantering already? They say you are capable.
Oh, not quite. My tutor does not say much either in approval or disapproval, except that my legs are perfect. I should never have suspected it. Full many a leg is born to blush unseen.
Dancing, talk and laughter, until at last the rooms at Whitehall are empty and they are left.
The two.
Playing cards together.
On and on through the night they play.
And talk.
My royal heart melts at the flatteries of young Essex. My whole being is suffused with lasciviousness.
Fearfully clever.
You should write something major.
Oh, no.
You should write a great work.
Oh, God, no.
Why on earth not?
I can't take it seriously.
What?
Art, literature, the whole bag of tricks. I mean, I suppose I do, but not in the way that artists do. I'm obsessed with people.
What people?
People out of the past. The past is the only thing we have not tinged with cruelty and bitterness. It is irrevocable. Its good and evil are fixed and done with. We can look at it dispassionately as if it were a work of art.
I see.
Do you? Do you really? You see, I believe a time will come when we will look back on even these summer nights, these happy summer nights, without a pang.
I do understand.
I knew you would.
So they say my Lord Essex cometh not to his own lodging until birds sing in the morning.
If only time could stand still for a little and draw out these halcyon weeks through the golden azure age of summer.
The boy, in his excitement, walking home through the dawn.
He really is jolly sweet and so clever and interesting.
The smiling queen in the darkness.
The down on his cheek. The delicious down. It's true that his nose looks stupid, but perhaps not too stupid.
But there is no respite for mortal creatures. Human relationships must either change or fade. When two consciousnesses come to a certain nearness, the impetus of their interactions growing ever intenser and intenser leads to an unescapable climax. The crescendo must rise to its topmost note, and only then is the preordained solution of the V made manifest.
Dear boy, I want to be worthy of what I am feeling now. I want our intercourse to be unmarred by weaknesses that I know are mine too often. I want to deserve your love. Let me stand erect in my own self-consciousness, that you may find in my strength the splendor that I find in your beauty. And let us be occupied, as well as with each other, and with ourselves, let us be occupied with the cleansing aspirations of our art.
Happy the days of the court, with hunting, feasting, and jousting.
Young Essex is lavish in his protestations of his worship, his adoration, his love.
Oh, Lytton! When was there anyone so unselfish and noble as you? If it weren't for you, I'm sure I should not be able to bear life now.
The Queen smiles upon him.
He's absolutely mine. I haven't the nerve to think of the future. But for the present, I'm walking on air. I don't know, I can hardly believe it. Is it possible?
She is lavish in her gifts.
She grants him the right to farm the custom on sweet wines for 10 years.
So now the poverty-stricken lord has a fortune of his own.
I saw a very nice youth on the tube. A nice curly-haired youth of the lower classes.
Nothing remarkable in that?
No, but he was wearing a heavenly shirt, which transported me. It was dark blue with a yellow edge at the top, and it was done up with laces, straw-coloured, which tied at the back. I thought it was exactly you. I longed to get one for you. I decided to go up to him and ask him where he got it. Pretty courageous, wasn't it?
Was it?
Well, you see, he was not alone, but accompanied by two other youths who I had to brush aside in order to reach him.
Goodness!
It turned out that it was a football jersey.
Which team?
Yes, he did tell me. The Express Dairy team.
Bravo!
But Express Dairy? I was so surprised that I couldn't think what other inquiries I could make, and then he vanished. I will never make a man of action like you.
It sounds like a lovely jersey. You were very kind to think of me.
On paper, it's different. On paper, I can carry things through.
Also, that should strengthen your resolve to write.
Yes.
You are so kind. Yeah, you are too good to me, too true, too great. I despise myself for not being...
Not being what?
I don't know. I feel for you a very great friendship and the utmost regard, but I'm so selfish compared to you. I'm just a brute.
My dear Roger, no such thing. Perhaps you think your affection for me on a lower level than it really is. I don't believe it's really more selfish than mine for you. You don't know what it's like to be my age. You don't know how humble and wretched and lonely I sometimes feel. But with you, I can forget all that. With you, I can return to the primeval forest. We can swing from the boughs entranced in happiness and sleep together far up in the heart of some marvelous palm. Never to touch the ground. How divine.
How can we do that?
We pretend.
Yes, Your Majesty.
You don't know how glad, how selfishly glad I am to know you care for me, my dearest. You do care for me.
I could never match the wildness and nobility of your feelings.
But you have an affection towards me.
Majesty.
Oh, he is a portent of fire and glory. His feelings transcend all. I have looked into his eyes, and the whole universe has swayed and swum and been abolished. And we have melted into one indescribable embrace. His features were molded by the hand of God. I rave, but I weep too. Looking at his face, I imagine the marks of time upon it. I see the lines and ruins and desolations of age. I see death too. And I pray that the whole world might stand still forever.
Lytton?
Dear Roger, what is it?
Do we have to be Elizabethans?
You don't like it? Well, let's try something else. I don't care. Who else? You could be Nero, and I could be your slave. You could be a prefect, and I could be your fag. I could be your manservant instead of Peel. I mean, actually. To have no will of one's own, hardly even a soul, how satisfying that would be.
Lytton...
If I shaved off my beard, nobody would recognise me. Disappearance of a well-known author, it would be delightful.
Lytton...
Mother and baby? Mama, mama.
Essex is fine. I'm happy to be Essex.
Did I say something to hurt your feelings?
No, my feelings weren't hurt. I'm sure you would never hurt me. I should apologise.
Whatever for?
Well, my beastly behaviour.
You aren't beastly.
You're very generous.
No, it's true. It's my fault. I have to overcome my wretched sensitiveness, selfishness.
No.
I must save you from the feeling that you were being beastly. There's nothing wrong. It's just my ridiculous nerves.
And my poor sense of humour.
No, there's nothing wrong with your sense of humour. I've got into the habit of making bad jokes about serious things. It relieves my mind. Like drops of lemon on a pancake.
I am so brutal, and you are so good. Was there anyone so unselfish and noble as you?
You are so kind to entertain my fantasy. I feel we're playing in a kind of wonderland. This discovery, this invention is such a marvelous combination. The intricacy and intensity of it reduces me to a shadow. Every moment is peculiar beyond words. Each moment of our play together fills me with a delirious, throbbing excitement.
I am almost too happy when I'm with you.
How can we bear it?
Music helps.
Yes, music. It works the same spell. It melts this too solid flesh. It really is the food of love. Mozart?
Bach.
No, too religious.
Vaughan Williams?
I always feel he's rather South Kensington. But I expect that's only because I once knew his female relatives.
Beethoven, the late quartets.
Of course. It's almost as though we are the instrument, you and I. How I shudder when I listen. The bowing of the violin, exquisite, taut, back and forth, in and out. In and out. Oh.
What is lacking in the good fortune of the marvellous Earl of Essex? He leads a great raid on Cadiz and returns victorious, covered in glory. The prowess and the person of Essex stand forth, lustrous and dazzling before all eyes.
Yet there is one pair of eyes, and only one, that view the gorgeous spectacle without blinking. The cold viper gaze of Francis Bacon pierces through to the iniquity of his patron situation and sees there nothing but doubt and danger.
Master Bacon, what's the matter?
Your lordship is a man that hath the advantage of Her Majesty's affection and knoweth it, and of popular reputation.
So?
I doubt there can be a more dangerous image than this, represented to any monarch living, of your great honour and glory in the late wars at Cadiz.
Do you mean you think she might be jealous?
Take pains to show Her Majesty you are not unrulable. Take all occasions to the Queen to speak vehemently against popularity and popular courses and tax it in others. Her Majesty is a prince that loveth peace.
It's true. She... is very, very queer. I respect her intellect profoundly. And, you know, she's a chap of such feeling and a fine imagination. I love her for that. I put up with a great deal, which I would hardly tolerate in another fella.
Your lordship should never be without some particulars afoot, which you should seem to pursue with earnestness and affection, and then let them fall upon taking knowledge of Her Majesty's opposition and dislike. Pretend a journey to see your estate, but then, when the Queen protests, relinquish it.
Oh, fooey, I could never do that.
And everyone knows, everyone apparently, except Francis Bacon, that the Earl is incapable of dissembling to the Queen. He comes into her presence and contradictory emotions overwhelm him. His young mind is swept along by hers, dancing down delightful avenues, happy twists, new delicious vistas, and then what happens? The twists grow abrupt, unaccountable, ridiculous. The young head spins.
Roger, where is my hot water bottle?
Where you left it.
But where is the stopper? I've lost the stopper.
I haven't seen it.
Well, someone has taken it.
Nonsense.
I put it very carefully upon the centre of my air cushion, and it has not rolled, it has not suddenly dematerialised.
Don't be absurd.
Absurd? Someone has stolen my hot water bottle stopper.
Lytton, you're being naughty.
Am I? Ooh. Yes, a naughty child. I deserve severe correction. Why don't you take me in hand? I ought to be spanked severely for some mysterious wickedness. Shall I take down my knickerbockers?
Not just now.
As you wish, Mama. But I can bear it. Remember, I may have the body of a weak, feeble man, but I have the heart and stomach of a woman. And a fairly frisky one at that.
She is a preposterous old creature. I'm a man, I should lead and she follow. But fate has reversed the roles. Why am I favored? Why do I have any influence? It's all too obvious. It is not only obvious, it is ludicrous. I satisfy the cravings of a 53-year-old virgin. How is this to end? I'd rather retire my sick body and troubled mind into some place of rest.
Angry and mortified, Essex retires from court to the exclusion of his house at Wanstead.
Perfect little pig, to pay no attention whatever to my repeated invitations. I'd been hoping to hear whether you could or could not come to me on the third, and I'm now left to infer that you can't.
Couldn't you have asked someone else?
Someone else? Someone else? Villain! The Queen must say she considers your conduct most reprehensible and doubts very much whether she will speak to you in the future. By God's death. The knave must be taught his manners. He shall be whipped and stand in the pillory and lose his ears, yea, marry, after they have been nailed thereunto for the space of an hour. Where have you been?
I went to Tristan last night.
Oh, Wagner.
I'm rather in a pulp. I wish I could die in ecstasy of song like Isolde.
Rather an easy way out.
I couldn't bear the beauty of it. I wanted to go straight to Waterloo Bridge and over.
Oh, no. Please, you must promise me that you will never do any such thing.
It seems to me that you underrate what I feel.
No.
I find it so difficult to express my feelings.
It's my fault, it's all my fault, and of course, It's much easier to show one's peevishness than one's affection and admiration. You do know very well that I love you. I am a poor, old, miserable creature. I am lonely and I'm growing old. If I lost you, I don't think I could bear it. Don't ever leave me.
Your Majesty's servant. To the death.
To the death. Let us float, weightless and insubstantial, like the airs that creep so softly upon the harp strings and fill the silence of the spheres with their legendary echoes. Then to the fleeting strains of fine music, lust and affection will melt into one. And we will be together.
Elizabeth's chief minister is Sir Robert Cecil. Sickly, hunchbacked.
No thanks.
But possessed of great abilities. A great worker, a born administrator, he sits silent amidst the loud violence of court, the brio of Essex, and the rush and flutter of courtiers. Thus, the court is dominated by two opposing factions. Essex, the favourite, and Robert Cecil, the trusted minister.
Secretary Cecil, I hear the Attorney Generalship is vacant.
My Lord of Essex, the appointment must be made in less than a week. I pray your lordship will let me know who he will favour.
Well, surely you know I stand for Francis Bacon. He must have the post.
He is a man of theory, not a man of law.
Her Majesty never in her reign had such an instrument to do her honourable and great services as Francis Bacon, if she will use him.
I wonder your lordship will go about to spend your strength in so unlikely or impossible a manner. Bacon spoke in the Commons against the Queen's interest. She will never forgive him. If your lordship had spoken of the solicitorship for Bacon, that might have been of easier digestion to Her Majesty.
Digest me no digestions.
Ooh.
I'm trying my best.
Go on, yeah. It's very good. Go on.
Secretary Cecil, the attorneyship for Francis Bacon I must have, and in that I will spend all my power, might, authority, and amity. And this be you assured of, for now do I fully declare myself.
Henceforth, there is no concealment. The two parties face each other fiercely, two dogs with one bone, or rather, one rasher of bacon.
The long, fierce struggle between the Earl of Essex and Cecil intensifies. A struggle that turns the council chamber into a field of battle. The Queen sits in a high chair at the head of the table, listening, approving, fiercely disagreeing, veering passionately from one side to the other, and never making up her mind.
I feel all topsy-turvy and out of place, as if I were a handkerchief that someone has dropped on the top of Mont Blanc. My brain seethes like a witch's cauldron. I keep ladling out the contents into my script, but it continues to boil and bubble, and sometimes I hardly know whether I'm on my head or my heels. My magnum opus marches forwards with infinite slowness. I've even turned down my invitation to the birth control ball. After all, not to appear at all is the best contraceptive. Certainly better than coming early. Perhaps the only supremacy is the supremacy of effort. I feel occasionally like an unchained tiger, do you?
Yes, Majesty.
Or perhaps always.
Yes,
Majesty. Otter, you look like an alligator with a jaundice.
I beg your pardon.
What is wrong with you all?
Majesty, the question of the Irish appointment has become pressing.
Oh, yes. Something must be done about it. I thought we had decided that Sir William Knollys is the man.
No, not Sir William.
My Lord of Essex,
I propose Sir George Carew.
Sir George, I will not hear of it.
Sir George must go. Must. Must.
Little man, must is not a word to use to princes.
Little man, come off it.
Why must you be so unkind? Why must you spoil everything?
No, I know what you're going to say. I'm a selfish brute.
Why do you say that?
Because it is a selfish feeling, you might say, to be whole in oneself. Not to need all this, or at least not so desperately.
So what you are saying is that you are upset because it's obvious that I like you more than you like me.
No, you're twisting my words.
No, I suppose it's true. When I look at you, I am carried away in dreams of glory. Your eyes. But no, I shall forget that. I shall shut that out. It's a little difficult to gather, but I think I understand. What you mean is that occasionally you feel absolutely indifferent to me.
Lytton.
A cynical person would say not love, but lust is all.
For heaven's sake, you keep saying that you are happy with things, but I think that what you loosely term things might be so very much better.
Oh!
Essex turns his back on his queen. She instantly
boxes his ears. Go to the devil.
My ears?
Oh, yes.
This is an outrage. I would not have borne this from your father's hands.
Essex claps his hand to his sword.
My lord, you forget yourself.
Get out!
You fool! Would you draw on your sovereign? Get out!
Elizabeth does not stir. Essex rushes from the room. Unparalleled, as is the conduct of Essex, the Queen's behaviour is no less extraordinary.
Her Majesty does as she pleases.
Her Majesty does nothing. He put his hand on his sword.
So?
So, the tower, the block, some exemplary punishment.
Nothing. He has gone into the country. She proceeds with her usual routine.
But what is passing in her head? Has she been horrified into paralysis? Is she overcome by the workings of outraged passion? Is she biding her time for some terrific revenge?
It's impossible to guess.
I feel like a primeval rock. Indifferent. Alas, the only passion I have left me is the black rage. My stomach struggles through endless sloughs of dyspepsia. Indifference. Last week the rector was married. Yesterday there was a flower show. Today we had haddock for breakfast. And tomorrow I will stab myself.
My Lord Essex.
Master Bacon.
Do you not understand that your present course is full of danger? Do you not see that you are encouraging your enemies? Have you forgotten your friends? Have you forgotten your country?
Well, how can I serve my country when I've been driven from court? When she has dismissed, discharged, disabled me?
You must beg the Queen's forgiveness. Whether you are in the right or no makes no difference.
I've been content to do Her Majesty the service of a clerk, but I will never be a villain or a slave. Say you, I must yield and submit?
Let policy, duty and religion enforce you to yield.
Doth religion enforce me to sue? Doth God command it? What? Cannot princes err?
Cannot subjects receive wrong? My cause is good! Now, look here, where is all this leading? These flights of fancy, he gets so worked up. And then reality just keeps breaking through and down he plunges. Sometimes I fear for his sanity.
The headstrong young man gives vent to strange expressions, Majesty.
This time I'm really going to be firm. He hath played long enough upon me, and now I mean to play a while upon him and stand as much upon my greatness as he hath upon stomach.
You know how many times before you have yielded in like circumstances. Experience indicates that the future may resemble the past.
At times, I feel terrified when I think of him. He seems like some desperate, proud angel plunging into darkness and fate. Why? He nourishes himself in bitterness and wraps himself up in his torments as if he loved them. I will do nothing. I will wait for an apology.
There are many at court ready to tell unpleasant stories of the absent favorite.
The younger generation is too much for me. I don't pretend to understand it anymore. They could do very well without me. If I let my mind dwell on some things, I get in a state. I don't know what, I feel almost as if I was out of date. I begin to wonder whether his intellect is satisfying enough.
You ask too much. Do you really think you're going to get complete physical, moral, aesthetic, intellectual, passionate, affectionate satisfaction in one person?
One has got to want it.
But do you believe you're ever going to find someone who's completely intellectually satisfying?
I am equal to any situation. All will be well. I relish everything. I will proceed with my life's work.
Which is? Putting out the flames? Or playing with fire?
I have returned, Your Majesty, for no other purpose than to attend your commandment. I receive no pleasure in life but by the increase of your favor towards me. But I must confess that as a man, I have preferred your beauty above all things.
Oh, fie. My Lord Essex.
The Queen smiles. Disagreements vanish, the gloom lifts, and hope returns. On Twelfth Night, there is a grand party for the Danish ambassador, and the Queen and the Earl of Essex dance hand in hand before the assembled court.
Two figures, together in their passion and their mystery, while the viols play their beautiful tunes, and the jewels glitter in the torchlight.
Perhaps in that strange companionship, there is delight, as of old.
If so, it is for the last time.
I have been more subject to your natural beauty as a man than as a subject to the power of a king.
What a fool I am! What a miserable fool! It was my sense of the value of our relationship and my fear that it might come to an end that made me cry out so loudly the very minute I was hurt.
It's my fault.
No, it's not you. I have a devil inside me. I feel I'm done for, that I shall really smash up and go under like a decadent poet. It's my imagination, my awful imagination.
Oh, Lytton.
Why should I madly beg for strange, unwilling kisses and be happy for a moment amid that warmth and that diminutive sweetness?
Oh, Your Majesty!
Why should I cast you from me with horror and mortal anguish and with unsatiable adoration and with intolerable desire?
You get so caught up! I can't bear to wound you! And when I do, when I hurt you, I feel so ashamed!
Dear boy!
God, what a miserable thing is a human being. There's no hope for us.
Outside love.
Oh, love. I cannot work. I've been idle for days and days. It's a wretched state of affairs. My nerves seem so edgy and disordered. What is the matter with me? Perhaps I shall abandon Elizabeth altogether. I might begin a novel. Virginia has just published another one about a lighthouse. It really is most extraordinary, and the lack of copulation worries me rather. I suppose there is some symbolism about the lighthouse, but I can't guess what it is. I've written a fair amount, and I really ought to continue. The affair is really nearly half done, but it all seems like nonsense to me. If only I could reduce Elizabeth to nonsense, that would be perfect. To pulverize the material and remold it to the shape of one's own particular absurdity. What happiness to do that. Perhaps I shall give it a try. And it is true, sometimes I have glimpses of an exquisite paradise where forms of golden boys embrace seraphically in far lands with languid lovers linking marvelous hands, almost as though this was all long ago. In a galaxy far, far away. I am more madly in love with him than ever. And we have sailed into smooth waters, but for how long I know not.
You are too much together.
I'm quite happy until he says something which brings it over me in a sudden shock that he doesn't care for me at all. He wants to escape.
He's young. He needs freedom.
And I get so jealous. I know it's foolish.
Let him come to my place in Ireland. Let him have a holiday.
Dear Maynard, I lead a dog's life between Elizabeth's love affairs and my own.
Let him come to me. We can go fishing. I can advise him.
My soul is diseased. It's raw. Every touch upon it agonizes a nerve.
Then you should have learnt by this time to avoid promiscuous embraces.
Oh, very well. A holiday. Suggest it by all means. But I feel such a dreadful foreboding. Illness haunts me.
Although you claim you're always on the edge of the grave, you somehow manage to avoid falling into it.
For now. Our bodies are like comets' tails trailing behind us as we whirl towards the stars. When we lose them, we turn into dead coals and drop into the earth.
Misfortune in Ireland. The Queen summons her council.
The rebel Tyrone carries all before him. It is absolutely necessary that someone should be made Lord Deputy of Ireland and put down these malcontents. Who shall go?
Lord Mountjoy.
We have a high opinion of his competence, and Mountjoy is a handsome man. Essex?
Mountjoy is a scholar, not a general.
Cecil, do you have another candidate?
Sir William Knollys.
Sir William again? Into Ireland must be sent some prime man of the nobility, strong in power, honour, wealth, in favour with military men, and which have before been general of an army.
A man such as yourself, my lord?
By God, I would beat Tyrone in the field before those others. Nothing worthy of Her Majesty's honour hath been achieved.
Very well. My Lord of Essex shall go into Ireland. I hear the fishing is lovely this time of year. Master Bacon.
Your Majesty.
No word from Essex.
No word from Ireland, Majesty.
I give him £1,000 a day for the army there. Yet he had done so little. Why did he not attack Tyrone? Why did he make so many knights? What is your opinion?
Some say my Lord of Essex has some private end of his own.
And what might that be?
Madam, to discontent him as you do, and yet to put arms and power into his hands, it may be a kind of temptation to make him prove unruly.
Is that how the land lies? Arms and power. Temptation.
You could telephone him.
if telephones had been invented. Do you know what I wish?
No.
I wish I was a snake and could wriggle on the ground.
Master Bacon.
My Lord Secretary.
Did Her Majesty hear you?
She did.
And did you blow upon her suspicions?
My Lord, they glow red hot.
In Ireland, Tyrone refuses to give battle. There is a parley. He and Essex meet alone on horseback at a ford in the river. A truce is agreed. The campaign is at an end. The grand expedition has dwindled down into a futile humiliation.
There is only one thing that can save the situation now. I must see the Queen. I will assert my power. I will remove Cecil. And I will make sure from henceforward the Queen shall act as she ought. And as I wish.
But such is the wild wavering of his spirit, he cannot tell whether he will come into her presence as suppliant or master.
He embarks from Dublin with a great number of officers. Days later, the Earl of Essex is galloping into London.
The court is at Nonsuch. We must cross the river.
With only six friends, he's rowed across. At Lambeth, the weary men seize what horses they can find.
The Earl reaches Nonsuch Palace.
Way! Way for my Lord of Essex!
He runs up the stairs and so...
I know the way well enough.
Into the presence chamber.
She's not here.
Into the privy chamber.
Not here.
Beyond her bedroom.
Your Majesty...
He is muddy and disordered from his journey, in rough clothes and riding boots. But he is utterly unaware of any of that as he bursts open the door.
Your Majesty!
Oh!
And there, quite close to him, is Elizabeth among her ladies in a dressing gown, unpainted, without her wig, her grey hair hanging in wisps about her face and her eyes starting from her head.
Her Majesty is astonished, delighted. Then, afraid.
Well, this is a surprise.
Your Majesty's favour is diverted from me.
No, no. What is the meaning of this? Am I in his power?
Let others live in deceitful and inconstant pleasures. I am a true votary. My spirits are wasted with travail, care, and grief. My heart is torn in pieces with passion. From a man that hates himself and all things that keep him alive... What service can your Majesty reap?
Oh, fie, my lord.
She laughs him out of his humour, laughs and flirts.
Fie, lawks a mercy.
She allows her instinctive pleasure in his company to show, but underneath she makes lightning calculations.
And your followers?
I outrode them all. Only six stayed with me.
Only six?
And when she is sure that she's in no danger, she dismisses him.
Be gone, precipitate youth. Change your clothes while I change mine.
Majesty.
But then gives orders.
Let him keep to his chamber.
And then...
Put him under house arrest. By God's son, I am no queen while that man is above me. Who gave him command to come here so soon? I did send him on other business...
Thank you.
Bacon.
Your Majesty.
You are his creature. You owe your fortune to his favour.
To...
Essex, my Lord of Essex.
I owe him something. Certainly, Majesty, as a private individual.
How should one treat this situation? Forgiveness or punishment?
I have the greatest sympathy for my erstwhile patron. I am greatly attached to him. Yet some would say he is a mischievous person, that his activities might be dangerous to the state.
How so?
I must needs say, there are some positions to which he might be ill-suited. To send him back to Ireland
Essex,
might not profit.
Whensoever I send him back to Ireland, I will marry you, claim it of me.
Majesty.
He must be brought to account.
It might be difficult to produce cogent proof of the Earl's delinquencies, and his popularity is so great.
Say you so. Very well, but I will make him suffer for his incompetence, his insolence, his disobedience. Does he imagine that his charms are irresistible? I've had enough of them. He will find that he has made a mistake. He has charm, yes. But what, pray, is charm? I should like to know.
The moment of crisis approaches.
Are people going to know it's me?
Where?
In your book.
No, of course not. In any case, is it not gripping? Is it not absorbing?
No, no, yes. Tremendously amusing. But what if they do know?
Well, what does it matter? It's nearly finished.
It's not real.
I know. And we do not live in a timeless paradise, but we can pretend. After all, what is real?
Maynard has told me he loves me.
What?
When I stayed with him by the sea, he told me he loved me as much as is possible for him to love anybody.
Oh.
He knows about you, of course.
Of course.
He said he hopes you won't be jealous of him.
Should I be?
No. That makes no difference between you and me. Don't be angry. Honestly, it doesn't.
Then honestly... I'm not angry. We can like each other as before.
Yes.
And kiss each other and go through the whole phantasmagoria of desire. But we can never be alone together. Did you ever wear my football jersey? I never saw it.
You can have it back.
I don't want it.
Listen.
Your Majesty.
Your Majesty. Having heard the voice of your Majesty's justice, I do humbly crave to hear your own proper and natural voice of grace. The monopoly of sweet wines will come to an end at Michaelmas.
And?
Will you renew?
My Lord of Essex has been very dutiful in his expressions, and I have been much moved. But what I took for the abundance of the heart, I find to be only a suit for the farm of sweet wines.
She will not renew. She casts me out.
You must have patience. To recover again, by ordinary means, the Queen's ordinary favour. Though you have it not in such measure as heretofore, yet you should content yourself.
Patience? Content myself? The time for such words is past.
To shift so wantonly, my lord, so suddenly, from sorrow and repentance to rage and rebellion, might well prove you devoid of good reason or right mind.
I'm no longer in love with him. I was certain that I was. Perhaps I was, anyhow, but I no longer believe myself to be in love with a person who bores me.
He uttereth strange words, bordering on strange designs.
The Queen will have me sent to the Tower. The time has come to strike!
His armed followers gather in the courtyard of Essex House. There comes a knocking at the gate.
Give admittance! A high officer from court is come.
Why?
To inquire the cause of this assembly.
Who is he?
The Lord Chief Justice, Sir William Knollys.
Sir William Knollys. Sir William Knollys, shut him up. Kill him.
Thank you.
So?
During all this, I find I have cloaked my proper feelings.
Have you just discovered this?
I've fallen into a part which is not true to my nature.
Oh, just come to the point. Blurt it out as fast as possible.
Maynard has been staying here with me, and I have fallen in love with him.
Ah.
This makes no difference to our friendship.
No.
I mean, I hope you will not feel differently.
I don't know what to feel. The whole thing is too ludicrous.
They will say this is the right and proper punishment for unnatural emotions.
I thought you loved me in your own strange, undemonstrative fashion, but you felt no more for me than an amiable attachment, which almost made up for everything. But now I feel so shattered. So abjectly shattered that I don't know how to say anything.
Your Majesty.
Leave us.
Lytton.
Has anyone ever told you what a bore you are? I am suffering too much. I've been through too much. Things are spectral to me now. Oh, there are cruelties in the world. I am in a wretched agony. It's utterly stupid and absurd as well as being incomprehensible. They love each other. I expect it's been going on for weeks. And they've kept it so horribly secret. And he came to me reeking of Maynard. And he never thought that I should know. I think the nature of love has been hidden from them. Their actual feelings look to me merely silly. They are playing, taking themselves in. Yes. To them, this is just a play.
So, my lord,
May it please the court, having shut up the Lord Chief Justice, Sir William Knollys, in your library, you, with your followers, went out into the street crying, to Whitehall, to the palace.
No, we went towards the city, towards St. Paul's.
So, then, may it please the court, you walked towards St. Paul's, accompanied by many followers in arms, crying that there was a plot to murder you, that the crown had been sold to the Spanish Infanta. Sir Christopher Blount strode in front, brandishing his sword and crying, saw, saw, tray, tray, and other incoherent exclamations to rouse up London. But those who were in the street stood silent. Not a creature joined you. All men could see you were in desperation. The sweat poured from your face. Your forces slipped away, and the forces of the Queen gathered against you.
I am sorry that you must take a lawyer's fee to speak against me, Master Bacon. I was once your patron, and you, my intimate friend.
I am required to act for the government. It is not for me to inquire into its purposes. You say you were compelled to fly into the city for succor and assistance, for the fear you stood in from your pretended enemies. There were no such dangers. There were no such enemies.
Master Bacon hath written letters for me, my lords, not so many months since, setting out my case to the Queen.
These digressions are not fit. I have spent more time in studying how to make the Earl a good servant to the Queen and state than I have done in anything else. In vain. To take secret counsel, to run together in numbers, armed with weapons. What can be the excuse?
If I had purposed anything against others than my private enemies, I would not have stirred with so slender a company.
It was not the company you carried with you, but the assistance which you hoped for in the city. The Duke of Guise thrust himself into the streets of Paris on the day of the barricadoes, in his doublet and hose, attended by only 8 gentlemen, and found that help in the city which, God be thanked, you failed of here. And what followed? The French king forced to flee. Even such was my lord's confidence too. And the end is treason. I read here from a letter found among your papers. Dear Lytton, you are so selfish you have lost the power of seeing what people feel. You are interested in them insofar as they affect you and no further.
I never sent it!
So you admit you wrote it? Dear Lytton, you can make nothing of people unlike yourself. Were you to undertake a realistic novel, your characters would be for the most part ludicrous. You are an egoist, and what is worse, a decrepit one. Your vanity blinds you to others' feelings and to your own absurdity.
Treason, betrayal, God's death.
The Earl is silent. Francis Bacon's task is done. Elizabeth withdraws into the deepest privacy at Whitehall. The fatal future lies spinning and quivering in her formidable grasp. Are there reasons for mercy? Most assuredly, but purely personal.
To abolish the immediate miserable past, to regain with new rapture the old happiness. What is there to prevent it? I extend my royal pardon, and after a short eclipse, he will be with me again. But I cannot trust him. The future will always repeat the past. Whatever my feelings might be, his will remain divided, dangerous, intractable. So, let him do his worst. I will be equal to it. I will wrestle with him, master him, hold him at my mercy, and pardon him magnificently, ecstatically. Pardon him again and again. Is the whole history of our relations then one long, infamous deception? Was it all bitterness and blindness? Did he love me truly once? Such dreams are over. I am just a miserable old person. He has betrayed me in every possible way, as a queen and as a woman, before the whole world, and in the sweetest privacies of the heart. That he should despise me, and with justice, is my lowest infamy. That he should register my tears and dishonor my abandonments, my failures, the miserable embraces I can't withhold. That he should say that he pities me, perhaps. How I weep. My tears fall on his death warrant like rain. Must I sign? Oh, very well. Off with his head.
The age demands a dignified formality. Stepping upon the scaffold, my Lord of Essex doffs his hat and bows to the assembled lords.
I have bestowed my youth in wantonness, lust, and uncleanness. I have been puffed up with pride, vanity, and love of the world's pleasure. My sins are more in number than the hairs on my head, especially this last, this great, this bloody, this crying, this infectious sin, whereby so many for love of me hath been drawn to offend God, to offend their sovereign, to offend the world. I pray for the welfare of the Queen, whose death I protest I never meant, nor violence to her person.
Elizabeth resists the onslaught of rage and grief with the utmost bravery. but her tremendous vanity, the citadel of her repressed romanticism, is shattered. And rage and hatred plant their flag upon its ruins. The full consciousness of what she has enacted presses upon her. She shuts herself up in a darkened room to await due performance of the sentence that she has passed, of the warrant that she has signed. She is alone amid emptiness and ashes. On the scaffold, Essex takes off his doublet and kneels to the block, splendid, bareheaded, with his dark hair about his shoulders.
I hope for salvation from God only by the mercy and merits of my Savior, Jesus Christ. Lord, be merciful to thy prostrate servant. Lord, into thy hands I recommend my spirit.
Mastery has come into Sir Robert Cecil's hands, but it is mastery tempered by anxiety and vigilance.
The great reign of Elizabeth will continue for only 2 years longer. The pulses of action have grown feeble.
I sit here brooding over various people. The wildest Dostoevsky novel seems to grow dim and ordinary in comparison. I don't know what is to happen, how I am to get well, how I am to finish Elizabeth. I'm so old, so decrepit. I'm not an artist. That's the truth. But what am I? I want to excel, to triumph, to be powerful. My health has collapsed. I've been attacked by some unpleasant diseases, among them vertigo. The doctor has ordered a complete cessation of work. I'm not even allowed out for fear of falling down in the middle of Piccadilly. When shall I ever be able to frisk again? Perhaps I shall go to the seaside.
With deep sighs and mourning gestures, she constantly repeats the name of Essex and dwells upon his memory.
Imagine a country morning in August, with windows open and late breakfast on the table and flannel suits and low collars. It was before the flood, when, as no one knew that anything would ever happen or even matter, we could all be happy together. I found myself standing behind him while he was finishing his smoked haddock. There was nobody else in the room. I ventured to let my hand give one stroke to his brushed and charming hair. Oh, I feel the same now. The same love, the same affection. But with what regret and what bitter shiverings round the fire. The best things come to us before we know they are coming, and vanish before we know they have come. Love is the very devil. But when once it's flown finally out of the window, one's astonished to find one can get on very well without it. Life goes on, even after one is chucked by some earl or other. I received a proposal that I should cooperate on a play of my book on Elizabeth and Essex. What would such a thing involve? Might one make one's fortune? Would one be eternally disgraced? Would the fortune counterbalance the disgrace? I have been introduced to a charming young man with a melting smile, dark grey eyes, and perfectly lovely ears. I have suggested a short jaunt to Rome with this divine creature. It might be rather fun.
Thank you. been listening to Elizabeth and Essex, written by Robin Brooks, based on the writings of Lytton Strachey, with Simon Russell Beale as Lytton, Harry Lloyd as Essex, Nancy Carroll as Bacon, and Julian Harries as Cecil. With music by Eric Wolfgang Korngold, performed by the BBC Concert Orchestra and conducted by Robert Ziegler. This performance was recorded in front of an audience at the Alexandra Palace Theatre, London. It was produced and directed by Fiona McAlpine and Robin Brooks and was an Allegra production for BBC Radio 3.
And you can find more editions of Drama on 3 on BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Discover a different musical dynamic with the InTune mixtape.
30 minutes of curated pieces from the eclectic side of classical music. From the beloved favourites
to the occasional surprise. Radio 3's InTune mixtape, on weekday evenings from 7,
and available on the BBC Sounds app.
It's just after 9 o'clock, and it's time now to join Hannah French on Radio 3 for the first edition of our newest programme, Record Review Extra.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the very first edition of Record Review Extra, a brand new programme here on Radio 3, bringing you more of the best music from the freshest new recordings. Each week we'll hear extended highlights from the albums featured by Andrew McGregor on Saturday morning's Record Review programme, as well as the recommended performance from our weekly Building a Library feature. It's the perfect opportunity to hear lots of great music and make some exciting new discoveries too. So let's ring in the new era with bells, courtesy of Paganini.